welcome to the Your Call Weekly Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who is taking some well-deserved time off. In the United States this week, one story overshadowed all others. Former FBI Director James Comey's testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee about his interactions with President Donald Trump. And if you have seen, read, or heard coverage of those hearings that impressed or disappointed you, we would love to hear from you in this hour of the Media Roundtable. Also happy to talk about the UK elections and their impact as well. But we're going to spend the bulk of today's show talking about two huge stories from the Middle East. One from this week, and one from this week 50 years ago. On Monday, five Arab nations, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, took action to isolate the tiny gas-rich nation of Qatar, cutting off airspace and borders, as well as economic and diplomatic relations. The move came just weeks after President Trump's visit to the Middle East, where he met with leaders of Saudi Arabia, and he went to Twitter to claim credit for the rift and to hail it as potentially, quote, the beginning of the end of the horror of terrorism. But the State Department and U.S. military responded much more cautiously, and now the U.S. and its allies, including Germany, are trying to help patch things up. So what is going on, and why is it happening now? What does this tell us about the critical but often obscured differences between Arab nations? And how much does it matter that Qatar is the home of the cable news network Al Jazeera? Joining us to break it down, someone who follows these things very closely, from Istanbul, Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Borzu, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And I want to let folks know that his recent pieces for BuzzFeed include one called How Arab Countries' Decision to Break Ties with Qatar Complicates Things for the U.S. And you can see that at our website, yourcallradio.org, as well as some other reporting that Borzu has done in recent days. This week also marked the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, also known as the Third Arab-Israeli War, in which Israel tripled the territory under its control and, more importantly, brought more than 1 million Palestinian Arabs under Israeli military occupation. On this hour of Your Call, one of the questions we're asking is, after 50 years, what are the stories that need to be told, whether it's about the war in 1967 or its continuing impact in 2017? I want to talk about how decisive the Israeli occupation has been in shaping the modern Middle East and where the voice of Palestinians is in the coverage. And joining us to do that, in addition to Borzu Dargahi today, is Sandy Tolan, who is a longtime award-winning radio and print journalist, professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. He reports on and comments frequently about Palestine and Israel, and his latest piece, published in Truthdig, is 50 Years After the Six-Day War, How to Make Peace in the Holy Land. And Sandy joins us from L.A. Thank you so much, Sandy.
Good to be with you again, Matt, and with you as well, Borzu.
Great to have you both with us. And as always, we welcome your contributions to this program. If you want to give us a call at 866-798-8255, we particularly encourage you to bring forward specific examples of good reporting, interesting reporting, off-base reporting, whatever you've seen this week that you want to comment on. We love talking about specifics. The number again to call is 866-798-TALK. Also, you can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's start, as we always do, Borzu and Sandy, by talking about some examples of good reporting from the week. Borzu, let's start with you. What's a story, a piece of reporting you saw that you said, okay, this is valuable, people should know about this?
Well, you know, it's really been one of those weeks. There's just been so much news.
Yes.
And so much intensity that no single story comes to mind, but just, I mean, or rather article, but like I think quite extraordinary what happened in the UK. It's been very much on my radar, having worked at the Financial Times for a few years and having followed UK politics rather closely, just and I think a lot of people are seeing it only in negative terms as this big mess. But I think there's a lot of positive developments, too, in the outcome, in which, yes, there is a hung parliament. No party that ran in the elections is able to cleanly and quickly form a government. But in a way, it's probably kind of good that this is a setback for Theresa May, because she's not been a very good leader to all of Britain. She has interpreted the recent political turmoil afflicting Western democracies in perhaps a very negative way, basically, you know, sort of seeing the angst among voters as a lurch to the right, when in fact, what this election shows and the performance of the leftist Jeremy Corbyn shows is that it's in fact not been a lurch to the right so much as a lurch against neoliberals like Theresa May. And I think it's kind of interesting, you know, I'm looking at some of the headlines because, you know, BuzzFeed has a very robust UK office. You can't even call it a bureau, it's an addition. And I urge people to check it out. You know, there's some great pieces there about how Theresa May have made one of the worst mistakes in British electoral history, on the one hand, but on the other hand, about how the new UK Parliament has more black, Asian, women, and handicapped MPs than ever before. This flooding of the electoral ballots with young voters, I think turnout was something like 70-odd percent among 18 to 24 voters, unprecedented in any Western democracy, has signaled perhaps a new era in UK politics and perhaps a new way for Democrats, democratic-minded people in the West, to get out of this dead end that we seem to be in.
Borzo, before we go to Sandy for his kudos, the piece from the week that he was most impressed with, I just want to follow up on about the UK election. When you talk about how, you know, when you kind of look at, say, the bulk of the coverage, maybe not all of it, a lot of it is, you know, saying things are in disarray, you know, here's the UK heading into its Brexit negotiation, and it's not clear, you know, what kind of position they'll be in to do that. Why do you think it is that, you know, I mean, you know, political journalists, I think the idea should be to say what's going on here and, you know, in large part, not always to say, oh, hey, this is a great development, or is this going to be good for, you know, X, Y, or Z political position? Why do you think it is that there is that tendency to go, oh, wait a minute, the prime minister is going to, you know, is not going to have a strong basis for what she's going to look at the negative side of that? Because also I got some folks sending me studies showing, there's one from The Independent talking about the coverage of Jeremy Corbyn and the way that the media in Britain had covered him.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is, you know, he's been really vilified by the press because, you know, most of the people in the elite media in the UK tend to identify with the sort of neoliberal consensus. You know, they're either center-right or center-left. And I think that's part of the problem in the West right now, is that people are pining to break out of that. They don't want to give their votes to the, you know, lying, efficient guy in a suit and an expensive haircut. They're really, really sick of that. And if the real genuine Democrats don't propose candidates who don't fit into that mold, then the, you know, hard right will. And that's the problem that we're in right now. And I think there's a belief among I think a lot of people, especially in the UK, having been a little bit in the UK press for a few years, they are very much identifying with that centrist point of view, and they consider Jeremy Corbyn a clown, and they've been making fun of him for years now, and his performance in this election shows how alienated that particular segment of the media elite is from ordinary people and voters.
That's Borzo Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed here on the Your Call Media Roundtable. Sandy Tolan, I want to come to you and ask if there was a piece of reporting or something you heard or saw this week that you said, oh, that's impressive, I'd like to let people know about that.
Yeah, a couple of things, but I just first want to follow up.
Go ahead.
In agreement with what Borzo was just saying about the UK elections. I mean, there are so many parallels to me, I mean, not perfect parallels, but to the dismissiveness of the media in the United States of Bernie Sanders' run. Everybody, I mean, for that matter, Donald Trump, but that's a little more complicated of a comparison. People were so dismissive of Sanders. He's never has a chance. He's just a spoiler. And then we see how close he came and how much he's moved at least the Democratic Party to the left and making things like single payer a distinct possibility in places like California. And who knows, you know, if there's a shift in Congress in 2018. So the sort of almost universal dismissiveness, I've seen pieces, I'm of course not following it as closely as Borzo has been, but I've seen pieces talking about even the Guardian's dismissiveness of Corbyn, And I saw an interesting piece from Rachel Shabi today in something called, actually I hadn't seen this site before, Vocative, V-O-C-A-T-I-V, talking about, you know, just be careful about making predictions. Brexit had no chance. You know, the Colombia peace deal was a done deal. Of course, they were able to renegotiate that. And, of course, Trump didn't have a chance. And, of course, Sanders was just a spoiler. So there's this whole notion, you know, of the great authorities who see through a lens of, in this case, Washington, where they just, it's like an echo chamber, and more people are not getting on the ground and listening to ordinary people and their concerns. And I think, you know, there's a lesson in the press in the UK and the US and beyond for that. So I did want to flag Rachel's piece, but the other piece that stood out that I did want to mention that I just saw this morning is in the Columbia Journalism Review, and you know, there's so much discussion lately about the differing alternate realities between the so-called mainstream press or the so-called liberal press, as Fox News and others would have it, and the so-called alt-right or white nationalist press. And it was interesting that to read this piece today that looks at how exactly these two different the narrative of the Comey testimony yesterday is being spun so differently. You know, you have James Comey essentially saying that Trump lied and that he was trying to stop the investigation. He stopped short of saying that there was obstruction of justice, but he suggested that might well be forthcoming from the FBI investigation. And yet the because of some apparent flaws in one New York Times story of February 14th alleging that Trump associates had communicated with Russian intelligence officials during the campaign, which Comey said was largely untrue, now the alt-right media, the white nationalist media, the right-wing media is basically using that as a way to discredit the entire narrative. And this piece, interestingly, points out as a particular strategy for 2018 congressional elections. So that was in the Columbia Journalism Review, just posted, I guess, yesterday. And the author is David Uberti. So that might be something people might want to look up.
Great. We will post both of those pieces that you pointed to, as well as a link to the BuzzFeed London Bureau, or as you say, edition, Borzu. That's Sandy Tolan you were just hearing from, who's a longtime reporter and analyst about Israel and Palestine. Also with us, Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. Borzu, I want to come back to you specifically about this huge story from the Middle East this week about this decision by
Which one?
Well, yeah, I know. We'll start with one. They all connect to one another eventually. You know, about these five Arab nations making a break with Qatar. You know, the kind of cover story for it is, you know, this is about you know, pressuring Qatar about support for terrorism. If you could just first, let's just take that on. Contextualize that for us. What specifically is Qatar charged with?
Does anyone buy this line?
Well,
that this is about fighting terrorism.
Well, I think
the Saudi Arabia is going against its cousin Qatar, literally led by a relative. Both of these monarchies.
Well, this is exactly what we
buy the line in the U.S. because I'm abroad here that this is about fighting terrorism.
Oh, I'm certain that a lot of people are buying that line. I think most people. I think that there's most Americans spend their time to the extent that they could, you know, think about. Oh, there is a Saudi Arabia, there is a Qatar.
I mean, how many of the 9/11 attackers were from Qatar? Anyway, This is a dispute between, you know, cousins, basically, and it's not about terrorism at all. It's about Qatar leading a rather independent, you know, self-directed foreign policy in which it, you know, has relations with Israel as well as Iran, with the U.S. as well as Hezbollah, with the Taliban as well as the Muslim Brotherhood as well as Egypt and so on.
And it, you know, has a TV station that's kind of freewheeling and gives a platform to just about anyone. And it's considered the biggest brand in the Arab world. And this is a tiny country of 800,000 that has managed to raise its profile. I'm sorry, not 800,000 Qataris. Total, there's 2.3 million people who live there. And it's managed to raise its profile way beyond its means through its wile and through its kind of interesting foreign policy. So, and this is about getting them under the control of the Saudi kind of Gulf Arabian Peninsula hegemony. It really has nothing to do with Hezbollah. Saudi Arabia, for example, right now is partnered with extremist Sunni groups in Yemen that are very close to al-Qaeda in its fight against the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in that country, in Yemen. Saudi Arabia also maintains ties with extremist groups in Syria and for years in Iraq and so on. So, I mean, I don't think it's anything about terrorism at all. That's just, terrorism is a slogan that gets you attention on Fox News.
And a lot of other outlets in this country. I'm just telling you from here. It's this line matters, at least, I mean, even if it is to critique it. So taking that context in mind, so why now?
I think that they felt emboldened by, and this is it's a little bit of a mystery, but you know, in talking to very smart people, they all say the same thing. They felt emboldened by Donald Trump's recent visit to Saudi Arabia, the very good reception that Trump got, his kind remarks about Saudi Arabia, the feeling that relations with the U.S. had been reset since the strains of the Obama years, where Obama was talking quite critically about the behavior of the Gulf monarchies. So I think they felt they could get away with it. And, you know, they didn't go after, you know, the Saudis and the Emiratis, which were also part of this. They didn't go after Iran. You know, that's too big of a kind of enemy to go after. You know, as a matter of fact, the UAE has extremely robust relations, continues to have maybe even in some ways commercially better relations with Iran than Qatar does. But that's a very big kid on the block. So you go after a little kid so you can prove that you can do it.
And what's, and I mean, Sandy, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, if I can add, I mean, I agree with what Burzu was saying, and I like to add also that I think I'm picking up on what you said about Trump. I think a lot of this is about Trump's comfort with autocrats, his embrace of dictators, as he has given indications that he would like to be not subject to democratic institutions and the courts, for example. I mean, it's not, I think, a coincidence that the first foreign leader that spoke with Donald Trump after his election was al-Sisi of Egypt, who is a dictator, and why the United States should care that much about the Muslim Brotherhood, why the U.S. should be aligned with one side in this. I mean, and now there's indications that they're backing off of Trump's tweet in support of the Saudis. But, I mean, here the Saudis, as Burzu points out, a number of the people who were the 9/11 attackers were from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is conducting a campaign of terror in Yemen, and yet we're embracing the fight against Qatar, which holds one of the, you know, the idea that they should shut down Al Jazeera is so absurd on its face, and go after someone like Hosni Bashar, who is one of the true public intellectuals in the entire region. It shows that the U.S. is basically more than ever, perhaps, comfortable with aligning with dictators.
So, Borzo, you wrote about the complications this makes for U.S. policy in the Middle East, and certainly there, we're talking about walking back from Trump's tweet. I think that's the life of someone in the federal government at this point, right? So, but if that's part of what's going on, but do you think that this might actually, you know, get some concessions out of the Qataris, make some changes?
I mean,
in how they
I don't. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not in a position to know if the Qataris are going to buckle, and I wouldn't predict whether that would work. But can I just say that I've been following the Saudi and UAE machinations in this part of the world for like 15 years now, and they've messed up every one of their plots. You know, they screwed up in Lebanon.
where it totally blew up in their faces. They spent a lot of money trying to make the government sort of pro-Saudi, and it's now, you know, basically under the control of Iran's Hezbollah, including their boy, Saad Hariri, who's basically succumbed to Hezbollah and is now under their umbrella. They, you know, screwed up with the Iran nuclear program. They're screwing up in Yemen. They didn't manage to get anything out of Iraq. They're screwing up in Syria. I don't understand why anyone would think they would succeed here. And as a matter of fact, already you have a defiant Qatar, which is basically saying that, you know, we are not going to back down. This is about our sovereignty. This is about a coup attempt from the outside. We're not going to give in on this. You have Turkey, which is very closely aligned with Qatar and also a regional power, agreeing to give airlifts of water and food supplies. You have Iran coming to the rescue, saying that we're going to help to the extent that we can. And you have Vladimir Putin, who called up the emir of Qatar just hours after Trump's ill-considered tweets. So I don't see this. I see this as potentially, you know, maybe it could work. I don't know. But usually these guys don't seem, they sit in conference rooms in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of lobbyists that are paid a lot of money, and they do PowerPoint presentations, and they think this kind of stuff works in this part of the world, and it doesn't. And so I think that just as easily as it could work, it could maybe just as easily totally backfire in their faces and bring Qatar closer to Iran and perhaps jeopardize the massive U.S. base there.
Borzu Dargahi, this is exactly why I love to have you on the Media Roundtable, because of this knowledge that you have from the long time of covering these issues. I want to bring on a listener who has called in about this, Max in Berkeley. Max, go ahead, and if you could be brief, that'd be great. We've got a break coming up.
Thank you very much for a very good program, as usual. My first question has to do with terrorism. Who is behind it? When President Trump visited Saudi Arabia, he targeted Iran and corralled a number of heads of state from Sunni countries to do something about it. And then all of a sudden, Qatar has emerged as the new target. But then, surprisingly, even before that, less than a week ago, Iran itself was attacked by the Islamic State. Can anybody make some sense out of all of this? And then I will mention one last thing. As a commemoration of the 67 war, I saw a piece in the New York Times that mentioned that at one point the Israelis considered using atomic weapons in the Sinai in order to, defeat the Arab armies, especially the Egyptian army. Can anybody clarify that story for me? I'm a little bit confused, and I'm puzzled and perhaps afraid. Let me put it this way.
Max, thank you so much for your call, and we're going to get to both of your questions after we go to a break. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Your Call Media Roundtable. We are talking about coverage of the rift between Qatar and its Arab neighbors, cousins, as Borzu Dargahi described it earlier, and also talking about the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, which was in 1967, which continues to reverberate to this day. We invite you to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back with Sandy Tolan and Borzu Dargahi in just a moment.
This is Your Call on KAW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. KLW is a media sponsor for the Moss Story Slam, where you're invited to share a five-minute story on a specific item every month. Mystery is the topic for the June month Story Slam. It's happening on Tuesday, June 27th at the Public Works Space in the Mission.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. You can find more information about the program at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about Antarctica and what melting ice there means for our coasts here. And on Tuesday, we'll talk to Catherine Jacobson-Rahman about her book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Today, however, it is our media roundtable. We're talking about Qatar and its isolation from five neighboring Arab states, also talking about Israel and Palestine on the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. With us, BuzzFeed's Middle East correspondent Borju Dargahi from Istanbul and journalist and author Sandy Tolan joining us from Los Angeles. We always welcome you to join the conversation as well. But first, I want to get a response to the couple of points that Max raised. Borju, let's start just by sorting out Iran, the ISIS attack there, how all that fits together with these other developments, if it does.
Well, yes, Iran is a Shia power, largely overwhelmingly Shia country that supports militant groups around the Middle East that include Hezbollah and Iraqi Shia militias and the Houthis in Yemen to a lesser extent, that many countries consider terrorist organizations. And one of those is, by the way, Islamic Jihad in the Gaza Strip. So these are considered terrorist organizations by the West and other countries. On the other hand, there are Sunni extremist groups, the most prominent of which these days are Al-Qaeda and ISIS that are also considered terrorist groups. It's been years now that we've been waiting for ISIS or Al-Qaeda, one of these Sunni jihadi groups, to launch an attack on Iran. As a matter of fact, ISIS's leadership was very critical of Al-Qaeda for never launching attacks on Iran. They've been pining to do this because Iran is supporting Shia militias and the government of Bashar al-Assad, which are both sort of poised against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And so, you know, this is an attack that was basically the other shoe dropping. People have been waiting for this. People have been expecting this. Iran has a disgruntled, angry, and oppressed 10% Sunni minority from which ISIS can draw recruits. And it did. All of the attackers in the incidents on Wednesday were Iranian nationals, some of whom had gone to Iraq and Syria and fought alongside ISIS.
A quick question before we go to Sandy. As a journalist covering attacks that are described as ISIS attacks, ISIS-inspired attacks, things that ISIS claims credit for, how do you sort out and evaluate those claims? Because it seems difficult. What that means.
Well, I mean, I think ISIS is like pretty, specific itself. They have terms called in their press releases in their press department. They seem to have a kind of criteria for what counts as a lion of the caliphate, as they call it, or soldier of the caliphate, or someone who is a loyalist to the caliphate, and so on. And so, you use their information first of all, and then you look, did this guy train in Iraq or Syria? Did he fight? Or was he just some dude who went on the internet, maybe connected with someone, maybe not even, and did an attack and claimed it in a video or other statement saying that he was inspired by ISIS or loyal to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS?
Thanks, Borju. I want to go to Sandy with Max's second question. He was talking about, the New York Times is one of a number of outlets that did a lot of reporting looking back at the Six-Day War, and he was talking specifically about the question of whether the use of atomic weapons was ever a possibility. You have any direct response to that, or kind of maybe start us off?
Yes, yeah. I do, Matt. I mean, the report I'm pretty sure that Max is referring to was by William Broad and David Sanger 6 days ago on June 3rd, in which it quotes an Israeli by the name of Yitzhak Yaakov. And the idea was that there was a secret contingency plan called a doomsday operation. And this is from Yaakov, who's a retired brigadier general, that would have been would have evoked a plan, and this is quoted from the article, that detonate a nuclear weapon atop a mountain in the Sinai Peninsula as a warning to Egyptian and other Arab forces. I've done a lot of research over the years in various archives about the Six-Day War, and I haven't seen this specific thing, but clearly the biggest open secret in the world has been that Israel has been a nuclear power for a long time. And this is consistent with some of the things that I've researched in the past, although nothing quite this specific. But it's also consistent with, I think, a kind of buried narrative of the 1967 war, which we're marking, obviously, the 50th anniversary of this week. And that is that this shattering the myth that Israel was attacked. I mean, Israel started this war. And one of the things that they said the reasons that they gave for having to start it was that there were 100,000 troops, Egyptian troops, on the Sinai border ready to invade. Well, I went through the Lyndon Johnson LBJ archives in Austin, Texas, and saw a lot of the correspondence years ago. And in fact, British and U.S. intelligence showed that there were only 50,000 Egyptian troops, and that they were defensive in nature. I mean, clearly, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, was making very bellicose signals. But one of the most interesting things I found in these documents was that he was also making overtures to the United States and the Soviet Union that he wanted to resolve this peacefully. And so he dispatched his vice president, a guy named Mohedin, Zakaria Mohedin, to Washington to meet to try to work out the terms of a peace deal that would avoid war. That meeting was slated for the 7th of June. And within the administration, Eugene Rostow, who was essentially the equivalent of the National Security Advisor, didn't have that title back then, was debating within the administration, Defense Secretary McNamara and others, whether they should let the Israelis know. We didn't have the exact same kind of relationship with the Israelis as we do now, which we can talk about later. But the question was whether they should notify the Israelis that this meeting was going to take place on June 7th in Washington, when Mohedin was going to be sort of smuggled out of the UN and secretly brought to Washington to meet with Johnson administration officials. They decided that indeed they would notify the Israelis. And so the Israelis knew of this meeting. And now, did they attack on June 4th? In part because they knew this meeting. There's no way to say, and I know a lot of historians would say no, but to me, the notion that Israel was simply a victim of, alone in a sea of hostile Arab neighbors, I mean, if you look at the map, you say, well, yeah, I see what you mean. It's 1 against 40 or whatever ratio you want, depending on if you're calculating populations or fighting forces. But the U.S. intelligence agencies and British intelligence had concluded before the war began that Israel had enough firepower and defensive abilities to win a war against all of the Arab nations that might launch a war in 7 days. And that was written in documents. And, of course, they did it in 1 day less, in 6 days.
So, obviously, I mean, you and many other scholars have spent a lot of time digging into archives, you know, writing whole books about the Six-Day War, right? This is something that has been a lot of thought and analysis put into. But on an anniversary like this, I mean, I'm interested, obviously, like each of these stories, you can really delve in and see these different angles. And I can see why certainly talking about, mm-hmm. well, who's responsible, you know, that's a pretty big one when you're talking about how a war begins. But I guess I'd be curious, I mean, you chose on this anniversary to write a piece called 50 Days After the Six-Day War, How to Make Peace in the Holy Land. And I'd be interested in how you think about when there's this confluence of journalism and history, in this particular instance, what are the stories that are most important to tell to actually be relevant for now?
Well, I think one thing is that incredibly, the 50-year anniversary of the U.S., of the Israeli military occupation, I mean, it's certainly gotten a fair amount of mention in this last week, but the reality of daily life under occupation Even though there are efforts on the Israeli side to say, as there has been for years, to say this is not an occupation, this is our land, it's essentially a settler colonization of Palestinian land, and it has been since the first settler went out onto the land in the 1970s. Right now, I think one of the most important things for people to understand is the reality for Palestinians. I mean, to say nothing of Gaza, which is essentially occupied by land and air, and surrounded, and there is a, you know, basically an economic siege. But to speak of the West Bank, there are hundreds of barriers, roadblocks, checkpoints, other kinds of barriers that essentially isolate the Palestinian population into very small cantons that don't allow freedom of movement. And this is, I mean, it's sustainable as long as the United States doesn't insist that the status quo is not acceptable, because the United States is essentially overseeing the Oslo peace process, which essentially sanctioned the occupation. It allowed further development of the settlements. When the Oslo peace agreement was signed in 1993, there were about 110,000 settlers on the West Bank. Now there's more than 400,000, and that's not even including East Jerusalem, which is surrounded, Arab East Jerusalem, surrounded by Israeli Jewish settlements. So one of the things that has to happen is, and hasn't, is an insistence on the freezing of settlement construction and the backing, which hasn't happened since James Baker threatened to suspend U.S. loan guarantees before Oslo in 1991. The U.S., you know, I don't see this happening anytime soon, but the U.S. basically has to stop wag the dog scenario and be willing to impose sanctions or impose withhold aid to Israel unless it really suspends settlement development. I think that's the first step towards ending the occupation and lifting the siege of Gaza. The other thing that I would say is that the idea of vilifying one of the only organized peaceful movements, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which include boycotting things like Caterpillar, which has been responsible, its D9 bulldozer, for destroying thousands of Palestinian structures when being operated by the Israeli military. I mean, I think the alternative to that sort of nonviolent protest and nonviolent boycott is violence, and I think so that also has to happen. And I think eventually, this would be a long ways down the road, but I think eventually people have to start looking at a truth and reconciliation process and an understanding that the reality on the ground right now is a one-state solution. People say, we don't want a one-state solution, it'll be the end of Israel. Well, there are other options. There are things like possibly parallel states or a binational state. But I think the recognition that the occupation, it has to end, that the reality on the ground is one state, and that we have to begin thinking creatively about another way of resolving this.
I mean, Sandy,
that is all a long ways away, but it's eventually, I think, where we need to go in order to resolve this.
And I want to let listeners so they can read more of your, you go more in depth in this in your piece for Truth Dig, 50 years after the Six-Day War, How to Make Peace in the Holy Land. We have a link at our website, yourcallradio.org. Sandy Tolan is an award-winning radio and print journalist, also author of the international bestseller The Lemon Tree, which is an acclaimed history of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Also with us is Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. And Borzu, I wanted to bring you in. We've got a lot of folks who want to get on the air, so we're going to be talking to callers in just a moment. But I wanted to ask, how is this anniversary being framed, being reported on where you are in Turkey, elsewhere in the media in the Middle East? Is it a big deal?
It's getting a lot of attention at this point. Everything is being it's not a big story. I mean, I think that the news channels and the newspapers are doing, you know, kind of dutiful retrospective stories and so on. But the big story, of course, this week is the conflict within the Gulf states, the
fight in Syria. The Raqqa operation also began this week. The effort by the Syrian Kurds and their U.S. Special Forces allies to take control of ISIS's headquarters. It's just not that much. There's not that much attention on this issue. Frankly, you know, I was just recently in Israel, and you know, everything is very placid. Even the, in the West Bank, it's just, you know, there's occasional protests, rock throwing, and so on. But you know, it's very depressing in that sense, in that this is not a very dynamic situation right now. There doesn't seem to be any kind of positive movement one way or the other in terms of resolving this conflict.
I want to go to Glenn in San Francisco, who has called in about part of this history. And Glenn, go ahead, and if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it. We got a lot of folks who want to get on the air.
Thanks for an excellent show. I understand there's going to be a ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery by the survivors of the USS Liberty, the spy ship that the Israelis attacked at this war and almost sunk. It was practically a sitting duck with almost no armor. About 35 sailors were killed. And it's been theorized that the Israelis put to death some Egyptian prisoners in the Sinai or something. This is the reason why they attacked it. And then the LBJ administration covered it up subsequently.
All right, let's hear from Sandy about that.
Yeah, I mean, this has been an ongoing story and debate. I mean, I've heard from various sides on this, and there are a lot of disturbing questions about what the U.S. knew, what the LBJ administration knew at the time, and whether, in fact, there was a cover-up. There are a lot of people who are obviously survivors' families who feel very strongly. I have to confess that of all the things that I've covered over the years on Israel and Palestine, I have not written about that, so I don't want to say what I know other than that it's there are some disturbing questions about it. And I've spoken with people whose opinions I respect who don't believe that all of the conspiracies that have been laid out in terms of the Liberty are factual. But that's about as much as, unfortunately, I can say at this point.
All right, let's go to a couple other callers. I want to say we just got a news alert from the BBC saying that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE should ease their blockade against Qatar. Interesting development. Ali in San Francisco, if you could come on and be brief with your point.
Sure. I'd just like to mention the fact that over American media, this fight between the Shia and Sunni is oversimplification of the process that's going on. Even though the division and the sectarian divide is an element, but it really is not about the Shia and the Sunni. When you look at the group that Iran supports, which is Houthis in Yemen or the Syrian Bashar al-Assad, these are, and Hezbollah, these are all national American term freedom fighter, you can call it, which they're fighting for the dignity and the boundaries of their country. They never conduct attack outside the borders. They never do things in Europe. Well, when you talk about Wahhabism and what the ISIS and all the Sunni groups do, it's just an all-out war on everyone. So it's good to mention that the Shia and the Sunni is not really the main element. It's more about the influence and the principle.
Ali, thank you so much for the call. We'll get Borzu's response in just a moment. Let's go next to Donald in San Francisco. Donald, briefly, your point.
Mine is about money and the price of oil. My impression is that the West and Europe are investing a lot of money in marginal oil throughout the world, so it's in their interest in creating destabilization in cheap oil. So everywhere in the world where there's cheap oil, you get instability, and the West and the Russians, everybody likes it.
Okay.
How's that for an idea?
Great. Thank you, Donald. Let's go to Borzu. Let's take those in order. Ali says, oversimplifying to talk about Shias and Sunnis, or to emphasize that.
Well, I think, yeah, there are more definite complex overlays. There is a sectarian overlay, there's a national overlay, there's, you know, even a generational overlay in terms of things that are going on in the region. Absolutely. But there is a sectarian war going on in the region. You can see the fault lines across the region. As for, you know, Shia groups not carrying out operations abroad, not so sure about that. Just this week, the federal investigators arrested two men, one in New York City, one in Ohio, or Michigan, rather, and charged them with being part of a Hezbollah-backed operation to possibly launch terror attacks in New York City and in on the Panama Canal. There's indictments that have been unsealed in that case linking these guys to pro-Iranian militant groups. So not so sure about that, that suggestion that they don't carry operations abroad.
And then what about Donald talking about, just in general, looking at energy and price
of energy? The oil thing is overstated. You know, everywhere, everyone is like, oh, it's like, you know, Robert Fisk, this clown. Everything's about pipelines, you know, or oil or something like that. No, people don't die for oil. People don't go to war for oil. They go to war for ideals like nation or, you know, faith or family. And so, you know, oil is a fungible good that crisscrosses the region and so on. But, you know, these conspiracy theories that say, oh, it's all about the pipelines or this or that, you know, no, people don't fight wars for that. Even the oil companies, they don't have the power that they used to have. There's a lot more competition from China and Russia and other energy players, including Brazil, for example, even from the global south. And so it's not the same game as it was 150 years ago.
And just to add to that, I mean, I've been doing a lot of coverage of oil pipeline wars here in the U.S. and North Dakota, Standing Rock, and covering issues from Texas to Louisiana and going to Oklahoma soon. And I mean, one of the things, as I'm looking at U.S. policy, that I think a lot of people don't realize that U.S. is now the third largest producer of crude oil in the world, behind only Saudi Arabia and Russia. And if you add in refined products, it's number one. The Congress has lifted the export ban that was in place for 50 years just at the end of 2015. And this month, or at least in recent months, the U.S. has exported an average of more than 1 million barrels a day out of its, you know, 9 million total. And a lot of that, 300,000 barrels of which, I think in February, was going to China. So what this does is it makes the U.S., for better or worse, a lot of people would say for worse environmentally, in terms of global warming and all, but for better or worse, the U.S. is now a much bigger player, and this affects how influential the Saudis would be in this kind of energy policy.
So, Borza, just to bring this back to you, so if this has changed over time, so the oil companies don't have the pull they once did, there's a lot of competing sources. I mean, there's no question the reason that Saudi Arabia and the United States are so closely allied has something to do with oil. So how does that context change?
No, I think it less and less has to do with oil. It's, you know, I mean, the U.S. has always had a sort of gendarme in the Persian Gulf. It used to be the Shah of Iran, and now it's Saudi Arabia. It's much more, to me, about security and having a presence, a U.S. presence, no longer in Saudi Arabia. That presence now is actually in Qatar. It proved too politically volatile to have a U.S. base in Saudi Arabia. So it's much more about security than energy.
Got an email from Jan in Kensington who has a simple question. She says, if these guys are cousins, what are they really fighting about? I'm confused, really confused. Well, Borzuso, obviously you're trying to kind of like change the narrative a bit from what we might be hearing in the headlines. Can you sort that out for Jan?
I mean, it's just about who, you know, Saudi Arabia is the regional hegemon. It's the boss, you know. It has the largest population in the Gulf region, in the Arabian Peninsula, not bigger than Iran or Iraq, but in the Arabian Peninsula, it's the big kid on the block. And Qatar is this little upstart that's, you know, trying to do its own thing. And, you know, it's like get in line. You know, it's classic, big kid on the block trying to bully the little kid.
All right. Borzu Dargahi in Istanbul, Sandy Tolan in Los Angeles. We are wrapping up the program here. Maybe you can tell us what you're looking forward to and working on. I know, Borzu, it's probably been an exhausting week for you, but what's in the pipeline in terms of your reporting?
I mean, I have a bunch of stuff that I'm working on, including, you know, stuff having to do with Flynn, the General Flynn, a nice story about his ties to a Turkish businessman here in Turkey. And other stuff, including about Shia militias in the Middle East.
Excellent. And Sandy, what's coming up for you?
Well, actually, pipelines are in the pipeline for me. As I mentioned, I've did a lot of coverage for the LA Times and Daily Beast, as well as elsewhere for from Standing Rock. But lately, I've been starting to follow the story in Oklahoma, which is starting to recover as the price of oil. West Texas Intermediate is actually set in a place called Cushing, which is known as the pipeline crossroads of the world. And it's a fascinating place from all I can tell from a distance. And I'm hoping to get to Oklahoma and do some reporting for various outlets real soon.
Well, Sandy, I hope that we can hear more from you about that reporting. Sandy Tolan is best-selling author, award-winning radio and print journalist, and professor at USC's Annenberg School for Communication. He has a recent piece in Truthdig called 50 Years After the Six-Day War. That's at our website, yourcallradio.org. And you can also find Borzu Dargahi's work there as well. He is the Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. Sandy and Borzu, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Great being here.
Always good to have you with us. And I want to thank everyone who called or emailed during the show. I'm sorry we could not get everyone on. This was a busy morning of listener interaction. Coming up on Monday, we will be talking about the melting ice in Antarctica and what it will mean for the rest of the world and right here in the Bay Area. Your call is produced at KALW. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who is on vacation. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Allie Budner produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. You can always email us with show ideas at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks again for listening. I'm Matt Martin. This is Your Call.